Merci aussi pour l'invitation, je suis ravie d'être ici. En comptant en fait sur le caractère informel et exploratoire de cette rencontre, en fait j'ai organisé ma présentation autour de trois citations que j'apporte ici comme base de travail pour nous tous. Bah, c'est le travail des réflexions pour nous tous. Par contre, je veux parler en anglais parce que mes citations sont en anglais. J'espère, je vous demande pardon. Je serai par contre ravie de participer à la discussion, de recevoir des questions en français et de participer à la discussion en français. Alors, I would like to start with a short fragment from the journal of John Cam Hobhouse, a friend and companion of Lord Byron on his travels in Greece in 1908 and 1910. It actually delivers a bewildering insight into early 19th century Athenian reactions to the removal of the so-called Elgin marbles. Luisieri also mentioned a singular superstition of the Greeks. They consider that the statue antiques in Greece are men and women enchanted by some magician, and that they will, at some future time, recover their pristine form. Some men employed in loading my Lord Elgin's marbles a few days past refused to put one of the chests on board, saying that it was an arabim or had a spirit within. And some Greeks who conveyed two busts to Captain Leek declared they heard an arabim groan and scream most piteously within them. Some of these statues, they say, have been heard to bewail at leaving their friends and fellow marbles in the Acropolis. For the, as we see here, for the uneducated inhabitants of Athens, je n'ai pas mentionné que j'ouvre ma présentation, ouvre en fait déjà, inaugure la problématique de la troisième table ronde, un argument politique, donc je ne sais pas combien sont étanches les limites, mais en tout cas... on ouvre déjà sur cet aspect-là ici. Alors, according to Hobhouse, for the uneducated inhabitants of Athens, the statues of Acropolis were quasi-animating beings capable of emotive expression. So they see, they groan, they scream piteously, they bewail against their displacement, against their separation from their friends, and they scare away, actually, the people who try to displace them. This is indeed a very, very literal example of the agency of artifacts, of the power to influence their viewers, to make them act in particular ways. One is compelled to think again in a very literal way of Alfred Gale's analysis of art objects as equivalent to social agent, as systems of actions intended to act on the world rather than simply encode and communicate symbolic meanings. The attribution of anthropomorphic qualities to ancient artifacts, particularly those representing human figures, is a recurrent feature in the records at our disposal of local pre-modern perception of antiquities in Ottoman Greece, published by foreign travelers, but also by Greek ethnographers and historians. Such second-hand sources are, of course, to be treated with acute methodological caution. Descriptions of Western travelers, for instance, often convey a colonial and orientalizing gaze to the locals. Here, and in other accounts of the kind, local responses to the sculptures are qualified as superstitious, the product of a primitive mind, if you want, dismissed both in the name of the rational, enlightened subject and of the new modes of appreciation of such artifacts fostered by the emergence of aesthetics and art history as disciplines, and also of the public museum. Such accounts of local perception of antiquity also indirectly affirm the cultural supremacy of the Westerners and their rightful claim as custodians of the remnants of the classical past, in a way. And indeed, most references to local beliefs in enchanted antiquities in travel literature appear in the context of discussion of the alleged apathy or disinterest of local population in antiquities and the lack of resistance to their removal. A most frequently reiterated story among Southern Haitians is actually what came to be called as the lament of the Caryatides, when the Caryatid was removed from the Erechtheion. One of the Caryatides were removed from the Erechtheion by Elgin. The whole town was said to have been filled with mournful sighs and lamentations of the remaining Caryatids for their abducted sister. It's interesting. I go to my second, and here is a list, actually, of all the texts that where this story comes up. I come to my second citation. It's extremely interesting to compare, I think, the fragment of Hobhouse's diary with, which I just mentioned, with the published version of his travelogues 3 years later in 1813. So we see here a curious notion, no more a superstition, but a curious notion prevailing among the commons Athenians with respect to the ancient statues, is that they are real bodies mutilated and enchanted into their present state of beatification by magicians, so there are new elements coming in, who will have power over them as long as the Turks are masters of Greece. And then it's more or less the same information about the Arabim, but we still have the refusal to transport the marbles. It's some Greeks in our time conveying a chest from Athens to Piraeus containing part of the Elgin Marvelous, threw it down and could not for some time be prevailed upon to touch it, again affirming they heard the Arabim crying out and groaning for his fellow creatures detained in bondage in the Acropolis. The Athenians, and then the conclusion, the Athenians suppose that the condition of these enchanted marbles will be bettered by a removal from the country of the tyrant Turk. Although Hobhouse was one of the most impartial observers of the situation in Athens related to the removal of the marbles, and also a close friend of Lord Byron, who overtly castigated Lord Elgin's dilapidation of Parthenon, it is clear that he draws a politically loaded conclusions. The marbles will be bettered by a removal from the country of the tyrant Turk. So a version that conveniently presents as fully compatible on the one side the local belief system and on the other side the actual outcome of Elgin's enterprise of the sculpture being brought to Europe, to England. On the other hand, it's important to note that as I said, the dismissing superstition is here replaced by a curious notion, and there is clearly a more involved engagement with understanding local worldviews, local epistemology, almost one could say, the statues, and present them as coherent. So the statues are perceived here as fellow humans who could not be possessed or exchanged, and who were to be treated in their own best interests as regarded the undoing of the spell under which they lay. The abduction of the enchanted human-like statues of the Acropolis that later came to be regarded as a national trauma for in Greece does not seem here to give rise to feelings of dispossession or loss among the locals. On the contrary, the act of resistance and lament for their displacement is left, so to say, to the sculptors themselves. I believe it's no coincidence that one of the very rare Western European, if not the only Western European, who actually overtly claim that local Athenians, Greeks and Turks alike, did not remain indifferent to the removal of the Parthenon fragments, one of the rare authors that actually spoke of the lamentation of the people themselves, avoided any reference to any reference whatsoever to the local beliefs regarding enchanted antiquities. The antiquarian Edward Dodwell was a witness of Elgin's operation on the Acropolis in his travel in 1801 and later 1805 and 6. In his travelogue, published in 1819, after strongly condemning the irreparable damage that has been done to the Athenian monuments, he pursues, it is impossible to suppress the feelings of regret which must arise in the breast of every traveler who has seen these temples before and since their late dilapidation. Nor have I any hesitation in declaring, I don't know, sorry, apparently a mistake. And nor do I have any hesitation in declaring that the Athenians in general, nay, even the Turks themselves, did lament the ruin that was committed, and loudly and openly blamed their sovereign for the permission he had granted. There is a sort of hierarchization, in the sense of the affected parties. First, he delivers his own condemnation of Elgin's deed, then all travelers should condemn them, and then he comes to the locals. And he continues, I was on the spot at the time and had an opportunity of observing and indeed of participating in the sentiment of indignation which such conduct universally inspired. The whole proceeding was so unpopular in Athens that it was necessary to pay the laborers more than their usual profits before any could be prevailed upon to assist in the work of profanation. You see here the choice of the very same verb, prevailed upon, that seems actually to come as, almost as a reply to Hobhouse's account, delivering the other, or the real, I don't know, version regarding the local workers' reluctance to transport the sculptures. Moreover, arguing against the accusations of the Turks that they have been they had a tendency to destroy the monuments or they had a kind of gratuitous ardor spoliandi, he on the contrary insists on how these works were respected, and even speaking about the Caryatids, he doesn't at all refer to the question of the whole story of the enchanted sisters, lamenting the loss of one of them. On the contrary, he kind of attributes even extent dominant Western European modes of appreciation to the locals. He says that the Caryatids were not only never assailed by violence, but attracted universal admiration by the beauty of their forms. So, just to sum up, even though those accounts are fragmentary, they can be biased, informed by specific motivation, or even contradictory. Actually, such indirect sources of the local responsive to ancient remnants do reveal very different forms of engagement with ancient remnants, with ancient artifacts, from those which came to prevail after the creation of the Greek state and the subsequent nationalization of antiquities, along with the affirmation of archaeology as an academic discipline. During long episodes of their dense, multi-layered biographies, material remnants of antiquity have been experienced under social and sensorial regimes utterly foreign to those promoted either by nation-state identity politics, which sees them as cultural property, or by modern scholarship. In the case of the common Athenians of Hobhouse, we are facing a kind of zero sense of ownership, a sense of non-ownership, actually, vis-à-vis the status. And this attitude coexisted and was eventually replaced by claims of belonging arising both by the educated Greek elite as well as by the citizens of Western imperial powers, who, in terms of ontological groundings, mobilized the discourse of kinship, of racial affiliation, to the works of our forefathers. I'm really just having one more sentence, of racial and cultural affinity with the creation of the sculptures and not with the sculptures themselves. That is just to say, I return to this pre-modern and pre-national forms of attachment to ancient objects, particularly those that are devoid of the sense of ownership, in order to, I return to these multiple biographies of displaced objects, that actually acted as repositories of diverging memories and social practices, that have hosted craving, dreams, and fears of successive interlocutors, custodians, or owners, in order precisely to reflect on the implications and the relevance of this multiplicity for our contemporary debates regarding the repatriation of cultural heritage. Thank you for your attention.